I'm going to go a little bit further in Paul's journey, and we're going to find him in Acts chapter 23. This poor guy, he had worked for months to try to get back to Jerusalem, the hub of his Judaism, the hub of the celebration. Thank you very much. You got helpers up here in the front row, Bobby. Put my microphone on. Thank you, ladies. Anyway, he had aimed for months to get back to that place of celebration in Jerusalem, the day of Pentecost. He went back there to celebrate with his brothers and sisters in Christ. He went back with the intention of celebrating. When he got there, he was made known of the problem of many of the Jewish people now have turned against him. Even some were believers in Jesus, but turned against him because they had heard reports that he was telling people to stop Judaism and get into Christianity. You need to become like a Gentile now, which is not true. He was not doing that. They said, you need to prove your Judaism by taking these men that have taken a vow. They have this length of time. Then they'll cut their hair as the Jewish Nazirite vow goes. And that head of hair is dedicated unto the Lord. There were some expenses with it. And they said, we're advising you, Paul, pay their expenses. Do your own vow. And everyone will see that these things are not true. These things are not so. That'll give you the clear path to talk about Jesus without adversity. That was the plan. He got near the end of that period of time, and somebody recognized him and turned on him. The mob came. They were beating on him. The commander came, the guy that was in charge of 1,000 called Achilliarch, with soldiers, and took him from the mob. They stopped beating on him at that point in time. Thought it was bad for their health to continue on, I guess. He arrested him and took him away. And then Paul said, may I speak to them? But he spoke in Greek. He said, oh, you know Greek? So you're not that Egyptian guy in charge of the... Remember the name? The Sicarii, those terrorists at that time that would murder people inadvertently in crowded places like at the day of Pentecost with small daggers hidden in their garments. You're not that leader, that Egyptian guy? He says, no, I'm a Roman citizen. Ooh. Okay, took him back, had some words with the council. They turned on him again. And then we find him removed from there by this same fellow to take him into protective custody. But he found he's a Roman citizen, so he would not chain him up, wouldn't bind him up. Paul was finding himself kind of lonely, kind of in a lonely, difficult place. And the thought came to my mind as I was rethinking it this morning, kind of like a worm coming up out of the ground in a chicken farm. Oops, you know, and he may well have felt like that. Everywhere he looked, man, it was a problem coming on. That night, the Lord Jesus appeared to him, chapter 23, verse 11, where we ended up last week. But on the night immediately following, the Lord stood at his side and said, take courage, for as you have solemnly witnessed to my case at Jerusalem, so you must witness at Rome also. We talked about this being God's problem. God said, you're going to go there, I'm going to get you there, and I'm able to get you there. That means he's not going to die here in Jerusalem. That was a little bit encouraging, probably. You're going to Rome. Now God's got the details to work out, how to get him from here to there. And man, if I had some great ideas for God to use in my life, it'd be so easy if you just do this. Man, he never takes my advice, even when it's in the form of a prayer. Lord, do this and this and this and this, and it never happens. But on the other side, I can look back and see what God did to take me perfectly to where he wanted me to go. And some of those were not the places I thought I was going to go, or the people I thought I was going to marry, etc. You know what I'm saying? Because God has got his way and his will. and he can get somebody out of the chicken farm and to where he wants them to be. Well, Paul did not anticipate how it was going to happen, but we step into that this morning. Verse 12. When it was day, the Jews, again, general terminology, you can consider it all the Jews or a specific group within them. And it is probably the group of them that came down from Asia or Asia Minor that had accused him of doing these things. We're going to kill this guy. We're done with him. Verse 12, when it was day, the Jews formed a conspiracy, a mob, bound themselves under an oath, which is an interesting word. It is the word anathema, which is the strongest word of curse, that this is going to happen to us if we don't kill him. Whoa. Bound themselves under an oath, saying that they would neither eat nor drink until they had killed Paul. And we might find a little bit of humor in that and ask them the question, what happened after they didn't kill him? They all starved to death? No, they didn't. Because in the Judaism at the time, there was like four different avenues of getting out from under an oath that they had developed. So, it's worthless. And I thought it would be worthless to read those off to you. It doesn't even matter. It's ludicrous. It's like, what's an oath worth then? Okay, anyway. Saying that they would neither eat nor drink until they had killed Paul. There were some 40 who formed this plot. They came to the chief priest and the elders. The chief priest and the elders, you would think, ought to be kind of spiritually in charge of things and might have godliness in their mind and what's right and wrong. Not this crew of people. They pulled them into the plot. They said, we have bound ourselves under a solemn oath, anathema, to taste nothing until we have killed Paul. Now therefore, you and the council, that's the rest of the Sanhedrin, the 70 elders that ruled Israel, notify the commander, the Keliarch, to bring him down to you as though you were going to determine his case by a more thorough investigation. We, for our part, are ready to slay him before he comes near the place. We're not given any details as to what their thinking is. You imagine streets like our streets where a whole army could, you know, work their way down. This is probably narrow alleys of Jerusalem. And their thinking is one guy is probably going to bring him to this peaceful meeting. We'll make a judgment call against him. I don't know what they were. Were they going to kill the soldier that brought him? Were they ready to attack all the soldiers if there was... I don't know what was in their mind. They had something in mind. And he was their main target. If somebody else died from the shrapnel, that's their problem. We're going to kill him. What a plan. Verse 16. But the son of Paul's sister, and that this is the only mention of any relative of Paul's whatsoever, except when he talks about somebody that's his child in the faith, for instance. So he had a sister in town and a son. We're not told the son's age, except he seems to be on the young side. The son of Paul's sister heard of their ambush, and he came and entered the barracks and told Paul. Now remember, he could come and go to Paul because Paul was not under arrest. He was protective custody. People could come and go as they needed to. I'm sure permission and avenues needed to go through. But he told Paul. Verse 17, Paul called one of the centurions to him and said, lead this young man to the commander, for he has something to report to him. Doesn't even tell the underling, let's put it that way, the centurion. So he took him, led him to the commander, and said, Paul, the prisoner, called me to him and asked me to lead this young man to you since he has something to tell you. The commander, wise enough, took him by the hand, stepping aside, began to inquire of him privately, what is it that you have to report to me? And he said, the Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down tomorrow to the council. as though they are going to inquire somewhat more thoroughly about him. So do not listen to them, for more than 40 of them are lying in wait for him, who have bound themselves under a curse, third time it's used, not to eat or drink until they slay him. Now they are ready and waiting for the promise from you. It's possible that this man already heard the request. Bring Paul. Bring him. We want to have another meeting here. We want to get things straightened out. And it might have been something that came to his brain and said, you know, that's a good idea. I'd like to be rid of this mess. Because he knew he was in trouble for putting the chains on to start with. Then he found out he's a Roman citizen. Almost had him beaten. Which if he's a Roman citizen, untried, not accused, that very Keliart can receive the same punishment as well as everyone that struck a blow. Okay, get rid of this guy. Now he hears about this plot. So now what is the Keliart interested in? Yes? Yes? He is bound now to another Roman law. This is a Roman citizen. He is bound to protect him from assassination, from being killed. Now this becomes his main thrust. This becomes the preeminent thing in his mind. This is going to move half of an army. It is that important. Because he's a Roman citizen. That citizenship. Something to consider about citizenship. Especially when God says to us, our citizenship is in heaven. Something there that goes much, much deeper. So, 22. Therefore the commander let the young man go, instructing him, tell no one that you've notified me of these things. Two reasons. One for your safety, and another, so they don't ambush us on the way out of the building. Don't tell anybody. He called two of the centurions. So two of them in charge of 100 apiece. Called two of the centurions and said, get 200 soldiers ready by the third hour. The third hour of the night is 9 o'clock at night. And proceed to Caesarea. That is north and west toward the Mediterranean Ocean, some 35 miles away, with 70 horsemen and 200, New American Standard says spearmen. And I didn't know this until I studied this passage out a while back, that the Greek word here is almost impossible to translate. It is probably a Greek transliteration of a Latin word, but they're really not sure. A Greek reading person would not know what that word is because it's not used anywhere else in all of Greek literature. The transliteration kind of means one that has a light arm. And so maybe spearman, maybe slinger. And it can be, this is really odd, extra horses. Like 200 mounts for these 200 soldiers to ride. So we don't know. Whatever it is, it was to ensure Paul's safety, get him through, get as far as Caesarea before morning. So that's about here to the Applegate River, essentially.
King James also says spearmen.
Right. And so a number of different versions have spearmen, but they can't be certain on that because of the problem with the word. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Whatever it is. It's a healthy army. 70 horsemen, 200 spearmen. They also are to provide mounts to put Paul on, bring him safely to Felix the governor. I want to read about this guy. Because I've read about him in the Bible and I've never looked anything up about Felix. But I find it on the interesting side. I hope you do as well. Just a couple of short paragraphs. Antonius Felix, governor of Judea at this time, was born a slave and freed by Antonia, the mother of the emperor Claudius. He was a brother of Paulus, P-A-L-L-A-S, who was also a freedman of Antonia, and became a good friend of the young prince Claudius in the imperial household. Through the influence of Paulus in AD 48, Felix was appointed to a subordinate government post in Samaria under provincial governor Fentidius Cumanus. In AD 52, Claudius appointed him governor of Judea when Cumanus was deposed, an office usually reserved for the freemen of the Roman equestrian order, but which he obtained through intrigue and the support of the governor of Syria, Quadratus. And it tells where this information is found. During his governorship, insurrections and anarchy increased throughout Palestine. Try as he would to put down the uprisings and regain control, his brutal methods only alienated the Jewish population more and led to further disturbances. Tacitus describes him as a master of cruelty and lust, who exercised the powers of a king with the spirit of a slave. That's the main reason I wanted to read this. The spirit of a slave, but the power of a king. So you can imagine where that goes. Despite his low birth, Felix had a succession of three wives. Two are mentioned here. I don't know about number two. Number one and number three are mentioned. He had three wives, each in her own right a princess. The first wife was the granddaughter of Antony and Cleopatra. You've heard of those guys, making Felix the grandson-in-law of Antony. The third was Drusilla, whose name we have in the scripture here. Drusilla, the youngest daughter of Herod Agrippa the First, who was unhappy as the wife of Azizus, A-Z-I-Z-U-S. Why didn't you guys consider that name, Luke and Natalie? A-Z-I-Z-U-S. That would have been a unique one, you know. Anyway, king of Emesa, and whom Felix desired because of her beauty, and who was persuaded through the intervention of a Cyprian magician named Antomas to leave her husband for Felix. Nero recalled Felix to Rome sometime during 59 AD, and nothing is known of his subsequent fate. So he was governor from 52 to 59. That gives us a time frame when all of this took place. Felix. So take him safely to Felix the governor. And he also wrote the letter, verse 26, having this form. Luke is saying it was pretty much like this. I don't think he was able to get hold of it to copy it word for word. But Paul would have heard it and reported it to Luke. No problem at all. Claudius Lysias, the writer, to the most excellent governor, Felix. And what's interesting about the word excellent is it referred, first of all, to the ruler within an equestrian team. Had something to do with horse riding. And then became a term of honor after that. So, whatever. Trivia, useless to you, but maybe interesting. What's that, Mark? Cool, yeah. Claudius Lysias, to the most excellent Governor Felix, greeting. When this man was arrested by the Jews and was about to be slain by them, I came upon them with the troops and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman citizen, or that he was a Roman. Okay. What do you have so far? A little reconstruction of history. It's the right elements, but they're kind of mixed up just a little bit for whose benefit. I think he's still trying to earn some more points back, you know. Oh, I'm the hero of the hour, you know. Came in, I heard he was a Roman citizen and rescued him. Not the exact way it happened. And wanting to ascertain the charge for which we were accusing him, I brought him down to their council. Wait a minute, what else did you do? You put him in shackles and started to stretch him to beat him. You didn't include that part, but that's okay. Brought him down to their council, and I found him to be accused over questions about their law. Which is, he's probably shaking his head as he said that, and Felix is probably shaking his head as he's reading it. But under no accusation deserving death or imprisonment. Good choice. And when I was informed that there would be a plot against the man, I sent him to you at once, also instructing his accusers to bring charges against him before you. End of the letter. Okay. So now Felix has got a decision to make. So the soldiers, in accordance with their orders, took Paul, brought him by night to Antipatris. But the next day, leaving the horsemen to go on with him, they returned to the barracks. So some of them left. They got him safely out of town, took him to the city that Herod had built for his dad, Antipas. When he had read, verse 33, when these had come to Caesarea, they delivered the letter to the governor. They also presented Paul to him. And when he had read it, he asked what province he was. Because this is a way to squirrel out from under the responsibility of making a decision. If he was from a province that he doesn't have jurisdiction over, then he gets to turn it over to somebody else. Huh. When he had read it, he asked from what province he was from. When he learned that he was from Cilicia, that's his province, he said, I will give you a hearing after your accusers arrive also, giving orders for him to be kept in Herod's praetorium. So this is Felix's first response. Second one's coming up in the next chapter. In my thinking, in Bible reading, I came across a psalm that I would like to read to you with this in mind. We have a setting. It's a historical setting. Would you please turn back to Psalm 3 with me? Not a whole lot to say other than the reading and kind of walking through the passage like we have this morning. But what I want to remind you of in this particular setting and as applicable for us in our real life. There is a God who is there. And there is a God who does care. Whether we can sense him or not, he's there. He is there with wisdom. He is there for comfort. He is there to protect us when we are as that worm that comes up in the chicken house. Psalm 3 is David. David is fleeing from his son, Absalom. His son is trying to kill him so his son can take over the kingship. And you can imagine all the places that his mind would go. But what is recorded here and in some of the other Psalms is a turning to his God. A turning to his God. And as I read Psalm 3, I got to thinking about this portion we just walked through with the Apostle Paul. Let's read this with that in mind. O Lord, how my adversaries have increased. Many are rising up against me. Everywhere I turn and look, there's another one. Many are saying of my soul, there is no deliverance for him in God. Oh, really? We're about to see what God can do. And for David in his case, we know the history there also of what God did to deliver him, not only in this case, but in many others. Because our God really is there. And what it is that you got that is hot and heavy, God is there. And you can turn that over to him as David is doing. But thou, O Lord, art a shield about me. Interesting, a shield is typical right in front of somebody. A shield all about me. Who's going to penetrate the shield of God? David's mind is nobody. My glory and the one who lifts my head, Let's look at that for just a moment. My glory, the one who is there to be magnified, the one who I praise, the one who I turn to, and has shared that glory with me and given me this life, but the one that lifts my head, I've said it before in this way, it's like he comes along to this downtrodden person with their face, because they can't look anywhere but down, and he just touches their chin and then brings it up. The one who lifts my head, the one who causes me to look up and see greater things, see him. My glory and the lifter of my head. I know that Paul was met there by God multiple times. He had to have been. 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 8 down through 10 is one of those occasions where Paul begged God, take this affliction away from me, whatever that affliction was, that physical affliction. Three times he begged God, he says. And three times God said, my grace is sufficient for you. You can handle it because I'm able to handle it. And though Paul then concludes, most gladly, therefore, I will rather glory in the power of God, that when I am weak, then I am strong, is the idea. In my weakness, he is the one that is made strong. Got a different perspective on things, as David did, as Paul did. You're going to go to Rome, Paul, and witness for me there. He didn't witness a whole lot, it seems like, in Jerusalem, yet it was big enough that it was huge. It left a mark in Jerusalem. So you're going to witness for me at Rome. And as you're going to see a little bit later on, we're near the end of the book of Acts. That's an amazing thing. But he tells the Philippian people, the whole Praetorian Guard has heard the gospel. God is able. A little bit more out of this psalm. I was crying to the Lord with my voice, and he answered me from his holy mountain. And the word Selah, I always take it to mean stop and think about it. Just meditate on this. He answered me from his holy mountain. Probably no words, but you know what? The knowledge of God's presence, the knowledge and the comfort that God alone can bring met David right where he was. And I am certain that's why Jesus appeared to Paul that one night, to give him that impetus to keep on moving ahead. You're not going to die here. Just keep it on. Verse 5, I lay down and slept. And I awoke, for the Lord sustains me. Anybody here into having sleepless nights because of stress or pressures? It may be chemical induced that I wake up, but my brain starts thinking. And here in his comfort that God can give, I lay down and slept. And I awoke. Where the Lord sustains me. And I see Paul just wrapped around this whole psalm as if this was a garment to him. This could have been Paul's psalm. I will not be afraid. That's a decision made of 10,000s of people who have set themselves against me round about. What's Paul's answer to the Philippians? He said, for to me, to live is Christ and to die is gain. Bring on your best. I'll be seeing the Savior. He didn't want to get beat up. That's why he raised the ruckus and said, wait a minute, this, you know. He didn't like the pain any more than anybody else, yet at the same time, I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people who've set themselves against me round about. Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God. For thou hast smitten all my enemies on the jaw or the cheek. Thou hast shattered the teeth of the wicked. It kind of makes me think I'm really wanting to be on God's side. You know, the image of shattered teeth from him who is big enough to do it is not a great image. But David sets his enemy in that place. God's going to take care of him. It's up to God. With the Apostle Paul, over and over again, he comes back to this place of praying for his fellow Hebrews. Romans 9, 10, 11, he talks about those fellow Hebrews that he longs to see saved, even though their enemies to him have turned against him, have done these sorts of things to him. Salvation belongs to the Lord. Thy blessing be upon thy people. And then again, stop and think about it. We can read Paul's story and it won't be the same as our story. Yet from that story, I gain courage that I belong to the same God that cares just as much and has a task for me and task for you, just like he did for Paul. It's going to be different, but he's got it. Proof is you got breath in your body still. You're still second air. You're still upright for the most part. God has still got more for you, and you can trust him with it. Let me open it up. Conversation, questions or comments. Yes, Sherry?
It's interesting to me. It just happens again and again through the board, but the very most religious people that were more upset about anything concerning Paul because of the changes he was bringing about were the supposedly the more religious, and yet they're willing to break one of the very big commandments that they base their religion on, thou shalt not murder.
Yes.
And they're going to plan it, plot it, and get others involved. And they're supposed to be leaders. Shame on them.
Over and over again, we see that. And yes, absolutely, shame on them. I believe that some of those may have gotten saved. And like Saul of Tarsus, repented. I don't know. Anybody else? Kat?
Just as a dumb aside, Felix means happy. I was not a very happy guy. But it also means cat. And
Latin
is the
Latin
word for cat.
Okay. I do not know that part. That's the cartoon. Felix the cat. There you go. Means happy. I don't think he was, though. Except when he had that next woman, it appears, in the reading I've done about him. Yeah. Whether she's married to somebody else or not didn't matter.
It's the same word in Spanish, too, feliz. Happy.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Just a side note on the Spearman thing. I looked it up, and Martin Luther said shelter. Or protection. Protection, which makes me think shelter like tents or something.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So another option that I had not read yet. Thank you. The word for Spearman could mean also shelter, protector. Something like that.
My words, just like yours, when it talks about Selah, could mean pause, crescendo, or musical interlude. You know, the songs were sung a lot, so that could be, I could see the musical interlude. I could also see at the end of verse 2, the crescendo, where many are saying of my soul, there is no deliverance for him in God. Like a crescendo, and then following the crescendo comes the next part. But you, O Lord, are like a shield about me. What a difference it is between those two verses. It needs that Selah, I think, in there. I think if you read the Psalms thinking about that, what does that Selah mean in this particular context?
Thank you. Thank you. To me, it gives me a reason to even worship more.